Subject matter of the Quran. The subject matter of the Quran is Muhammad's indhar. Every page of the Quran speaks of this reality. The reason for this is that the Quran has not merely been revealed as an amalgam of Sharia and Hikmah. It has also been revealed to become the real means of the Prophet's indhar to his people. And this Quran has been revealed to me that I may warn you through it and all whom it may reach. Surah 6, verse 19. It is known that Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was not merely a Nabi or Prophet. He was also a Rasul or Messenger. Prophets are personalities whom the Almighty reveals divine guidance so that they can guide people. However, not every prophet is a messenger. Messengerhood is a position bestowed to only some prophets. According to its details furnished by the Quran, a Rasul decides the fate of his addressees and implements the judgment of God on them in this very world. The Quran informs us that this final phase in the preaching endeavor of a Rasul comes after it passes through the phases of Indhar, Indhar-i-Am, Itmamul-Hujja, and Hijra wa Bara'a. It is in this phase that the divine court of justice is set up on this earth. Punishment is meted out to the rejectors of the truth, and those who have accepted it are rewarded. And in this way, a miniature day of judgment is witnessed on the face of the earth. The history of the preaching endeavors of the Rasul related in the Quran shows that at this stage, generally either of the following two situations arise. Firstly, a Rasul has a few companions only, and there is no place available to him for migration. Secondly, a Rasul's companions are in substantial numbers, and the Almighty also furnishes a place to them, where they can migrate and be bestowed with political authority. In both these situations, the established practice of the Almighty manifests itself, the practice which the Quran refers to in the following words. Indeed, those who are opposing Allah and His Messenger are bound to be humiliated. The Almighty has ordained, I and my Messenger shall always prevail. Indeed, Allah is mighty and powerful. Surah 58, verses 20 to 21. In the first situation, once a Rasul has left his people, divine punishment in the form of raging storms, cyclones, and other calamities descends upon those who have rejected him, and completely destroys them. It is evident from the Quran that the people of Noah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Lot sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Salih sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and Shu'aib sallallahu alaihi wasallam, besides others, met with this dreadful fate. The only exception in this case were the Israelites. Since they primarily adhered to monotheism instead of annihilation, the punishment of subjugation was meted out to them once the Prophet Jesus sallallahu alaihi wasallam left them. In the second situation, a Rasul and his companions subdue their nation by force. In this case, the addressees of the Rasul are given some more respite, for he delivers the truth to the people of the place he has migrated to, till the extent that they too are left with no excuse to deny it. Also, during this time he instructs and purifies his followers and isolates them from his rejectors, and organizes them to fight the enemy. He also consolidates his political authority in the place he has migrated, to the extent that with its help, he is able to destroy his rejectors and achieve victory for his followers. In the case of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, this second situation arose. Consequently, the subject matter of the Quran is the account of his indhar, which passed through various phases referred to above, and culminated in the worldly reward and retribution of his addressees. Each of its surahs has been revealed in this background, and each of its groups have been arranged keeping it in view. While taking into consideration the subject matter of the Quran, the following three things should thus always remain in consideration before a student of the Quran vis-a-vis its exegesis and interpretation. Firstly, after deliberation of the contents of a surah, the exact phase in which it was revealed should be determined. So deep and accurate is a person required to go in this endeavor that he is able to very satisfactorily say that, for example, a surah has been revealed in the phase of indhar, or in the phase of migration, and acquittal, or in the phase of reward and punishment. Each verse of a surah also should be interpreted keeping in view this distinction. Secondly, the addressees of each surah must be determined from among people present at the time of revelation of the Quran. They could be the idolaters, the people of the book, the hypocrites, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his followers, or some specific group from among these denominations. It must also be determined if parts of a surah address a secondary addressee, besides the primary one. Consequently, the antecedent of every pronoun, the referred to entity of every defining article, alif lam, and the connotation of every term and expression should be determined in the light of the addressees of the surah. Thirdly, it must be determined, specially in case of directives which relate to jihad, supremacy of the truth and political authority, as a result of this supremacy, whether they are a permanent directive of Sharia or if they specifically relate to the addressees of the prophetic times, and the directive cannot be extended beyond these addressees. Coherence in the discourse. Each surah is a coherent collection of verses. These verses are not disjointed and haphazardly placed in a surah. In fact, each surah has a theme, and all the verses are aptly placed with regard to this theme. When a surah is studied while keeping in consideration its theme, and when its coherence becomes evident as a result of this study, it comes out as a well-knit unit. What is the value of this coherence? While answering this question, Imam Amin Ahsan Islahi writes, "It is absolutely incorrect to think that nazm or coherence is merely a subtle thing, which has no importance as regards to the real objective of Islam. In my consideration, its real worth stems from the fact that it is the door through which the real knowledge and wisdom of the Quran can be reached. A person who reads the Quran without the guidance of nazm will at best be able to understand some independent and solitary directives. Although the knowledge of independent and solitary directives is also valuable, however, there is a world of difference in having knowledge of the effects of certain plants and herbs from a dictionary of medical terms, and in the fact that an adept doctor prepares a prescription from all these ingredients which totally cures the patient. The brick and fabric of the Taj Mahal would have been used in many different buildings of the world. However, in spite of this, there is only one Taj Mahal. Without any real comparison, I would say that the words and sentences of the Quran all belong to the Arabic language. However, the unparalleled arrangement of the Quran has bestowed on them the ambiance and beauty which nothing on this earth can rival. Just as families have genealogies, pious and evil deeds too have genealogies. Sometimes we regard a pious deed to be an ordinary one, whereas it actually belongs to the family of pious deeds from which the branches of great pious deeds originate. Similarly, sometimes we regard an evil deed to be ordinary, whereas it belongs to that family of evil deeds from which originate the deadliest of diseases. A person who wants to understand the wisdom of religion should be aware of all these steps and stages of pious and evil deeds. Otherwise, there is a strong chance that he would end up considering a disease, which is a harbinger to tuberculosis, as the one which foretells of influenza and vice versa. The wisdom of the Quran is not evident from isolated parts of its discourse, but from its coherence and arrangement. If a person is aware of the individual verses of a surah, but is not aware of the meaningful coherence that exists between these verses, then he will never be able to have access to this wisdom. Similarly, the Quran has furnished historical arguments as well as the ones found in human nature and in the external world in order to substantiate some principal premise. When a person who is aware of this arrangement deliberates on a surah, he will feel that he has read a very comprehensive, well-reasoned, and satisfying discourse on the topic under discussion. On the other hand, a person who is not aware of this arrangement may have an idea of the contents of the discourse, but it will be deprived of the wisdom found in the surah. Reference Amin Ahsan Islahi, Tadabbur al-Quran, Volume 1, 20-21. After that, he has explained the importance of Quranic coherence with reference to the collective and political unity of the Muslims. Every person knows that it is the strong rope of the Quran that holds together the fabric of this ummah, and all Muslims have been directed to hold steadfast to this rope and not divide themselves into factions. An obvious requirement of this directive is that we must turn to the Quran to resolve all differences which arise among us. However, it is very unfortunate that all of us have different opinions regarding the Quran. There are so many views in the interpretation of every verse, and most of these views are contradictory to one another, and we do not have any reference point to decide which view is the correct one. If a difference of opinion arises in the interpretation of a discourse, the most satisfactory thing which can resolve this is the context and coherence of the discourse. Unfortunately, most people do not regard the Quran to be a coherent book having a definite context. The result is that differences of opinions have become permanent. A lot of differences of opinion which have arisen in fiqh, are because of disregarding the context of a verse. If this context is kept in consideration, one will find that on most occasions only one interpretation is possible. More critical than the issue of juristic differences is the case of misguided sects. Most of these sects have lent credence to their beliefs through various verses of the Quran. They normally sever a verse from its context and then interpret it the way they want to. Obviously, once a sentence is severed from its context, one can attribute multiple meanings to it if one wants to. Some of these meanings could never have even been imagined by the author, but for the fear of consuming a lot of space, I could have given several examples of verses which have been misinterpreted owing to this approach and have wreaked havoc with the actual meaning they imply. However, no one seems to be bothered to just look up the context and placement of the verse. He does not give any importance to these aspects if the Quran is being deliberated upon. It is evident from the foregoing discussion that what makes the Quran a document having one meaning and which resolves all differences of interpretation and thus verifies Imam al-Farahi's words, there is no possibility of more than one interpretation in the Quran. About it is the coherence it possesses. Imam Amin Ehsan Islahi writes, "In my exegesis, I have tried to determine a single interpretation of each Quranic verse because I have given full importance to the context and coherence in the verses. In fact, the truth of the matter is that I have been forced into this because the context and coherence in the verses have not allowed me to swerve from this. The right interpretation becomes so clear and obvious, and if a person is not deeply prejudiced, he can give his life but he cannot bear to deviate from it." Reference Amin Ehsan Islahi, Tadabbur-e-Quran, Volume 1, page 22. It is because of this coherence in the Quran that when it called upon its addressees to emulate it, it did not ask them to produce independent verses, but to produce one or more surahs like it. "And if you are in doubt about what we have revealed to our servant, then go and produce a single surah like it. And for this purpose, also call your leaders besides Allah, if you are truthful in your claim." Surah 2, verse 23. "Do they say, 'He has forged it himself'? Tell them, produce 10 inventful surahs like it, and call on whom you can except God if you are truthful." Surah 11, verse 13. The way the exponents of the Farahi school of thought have revealed the coherence in the Quran does not require any further discussion to prove that it does exist. However, what is the nature of this coherence? The following points will help in understanding it. Each surah has a theme round which its contents revolve and make it into a unified whole. It is the most comprehensive statement of its contents and what the soul is to a body, the theme is to a surah. Together with the main text of a surah, there is an introduction and a conclusion. The content of a surah in some cases can be divided into sections and paragraphs, and in other cases only in paragraphs. Paragraphs depict small shifts in the subject and sections depict greater shifts in it. The verses of the introduction and of the conclusion also may at times be divided into paragraphs as per the subject they discuss. These paragraphs and these sections relate to each other, not through a verse-to-verse linear connection, but through various literary devices like parables, comparison, or parallelism, as well as thorough statements and passages which are conditional, parenthetical, inferential, modifying, cyclic, or which signify corollaries, conclusions, questions, or answers. This, of course, is not an exhaustive list. The text of a surah progresses through these paragraphs and sections and gradually reaches its culmination. As a result, the surah assumes a distinct and unique form and shape and becomes a complete and independent whole. Arrangement of the Quran. The surahs of the Quran are not haphazardly compiled as is generally thought. They have been arranged in a specific order by the Almighty. And like the arrangement of the verses within a surah, the arrangement of the surahs within the Quran is very apt and meaningful with relation to the topic they discuss. In a nutshell, as per this arrangement, the Quran is divided in 7 distinct groups and the surahs within each group occur in pairs. This pairing of the surahs is on the basis of the topics discussed, and each member of a pair has a complementary relation with one another. Some surahs are an exception to this scheme, like Surah Fatiha, which is like an introduction to the whole Quran. Some other surahs have come as a supplement or as a conclusion of a group. This scheme, with its 7 surah groups and pairing of the surahs, is stated by the Quran in the following words. And O Prophet, we have bestowed upon you 7 Mathani, which is the Great Quran. Surah 15, verse 87. For an explanation of this verse, see Amin Ehsan Islahi Tadabbur-e-Quran, volume 4, pages 377 to 378. Each group of the Quran begins with one or more Makkan surah and ends with one or more Madinan surah. The following is a brief description of the 7 Quranic groups. Group 1, Surah Fatiha to Surah Maida. Makkan 1, Madinan 2-5. Group 2, Surah An-Nam to Surah Tawbah. Makkan 6-7, Madinan 8-9. Group 3, Surah Yunus to Surah Nur. Makkan 10-23, Madinan 24. Group 4, Surah Furqan to Surah Azab. Makkan 25-32, Madinan 33. Group 5, Surah Sabah to Surah Hujurat. Makkan 34-46, Madinan 47-49. Group 6, Surah Kaf to Surah Tarim. Makkan 50-56, Madinan 57-66. Group 7, Surah Mulk to Surah Nas. Makkan 67-112, Madinan 113-114. Each group has a theme, and the surahs within it are arranged according to this theme. The theme of the first group is to communicate the truth to the Jews and Christians to the extent that they are left with no excuse to deny it, to institute a new ummah from among the Ishmaelites, its spiritual purification and isolation from the disbelievers, and a description of its final covenant with the Almighty. The theme of the second group is to communicate the truth to the polytheists of Arabia, to the extent that they are left with no excuse to deny it, spiritual purification of the believers and their isolation from the disbelievers, and a description of the final worldly judgment of God. The third, fourth, fifth, and sixth groups have the same theme, delivering warning and glad tidings and spiritual purification of the believers and their isolation from the disbelievers. The theme of the seventh group is to warn the leadership of the Quraysh of the consequences of the hereafter, to communicate the truth to them to the extent that they are left with no excuse to deny it, and as a result, to warn them of a severe punishment, and to give glad tidings to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam of the dominance of his religion in the Arabian Peninsula. Briefly, this can be stated as delivering warnings and glad tidings. If the first group is not taken into consideration, the sequence of the groups is from the end to the beginning, the seventh to the second group. Consequently, the seventh group ends on delivering warnings and glad tidings. After that, in the sixth, fifth, fourth, and third groups, besides the theme of delivering warning and glad tidings, the theme of spiritual purification of the believers and their isolation from the disbelievers is also added. The second group is the culmination of the groups. It is here that the indhar of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam reaches its culmination too. Thus, besides the themes of delivering warnings and glad tidings, and the spiritual purification of the believers and their isolation from the disbelievers, the worldly judgment of God is also depicted, which is actually a miniature day of judgment that will take place before the actual day of judgment. The first group specifically addresses the people of the book instead of the polytheists of Arabia, and in this respect differs from the rest. However, it too relates to the worldly judgment pronounced in the second group in Surah Tawbah in the very manner the rest of the groups relate to it. Thus, the second group is the culmination of all the groups. The topic of indhar, after passing through various phases, reaches its peak of worldly judgment in this group from both sides. The only difference are the addressees. It is evident from this that from the seventh to the second group, an ascending order arrangement is present, in order to relate it with the first group in this manner. The first group has been placed the foremost because the recipients of the Quran are its addressees the foremost. Except for the first group, the Makkan surahs of each group discuss delivering of warning and glad tidings, and of communicating the truth to the addressees to the extent that they do not have any excuse to deny it, while the Madinan surahs discuss the spiritual purification and isolation of the believers. However, both the Makkan and Madinan surahs are in harmony and consonance with one another in each group, and relate to one another in a manner a root and stem are related to the branches. This then is the arrangement of the Quran. If it is deliberated upon at length, the extent of guidance it provides to a student of the Quran in understanding the background of the surahs and their time of revelation and the addressees of the Quran, as well in determining the topic of a surah and its purport, cannot be obtained whatsoever from anything external to the Quran. And for this purpose, also call your leaders besides Allah, if you are truthful in your claim. Surah 2, verse 23. Do they say, "He has forged it himself"? Tell them, produce 10 inventful surahs like it, and call on whom you can except God if you are truthful. Surah 11, verse 13. The way the exponents of the Farahi school of thought have revealed the coherence in the Quran does not require any further discussion to prove that it does exist. However, what is the nature of this coherence? The following points will help in understanding it. 1. Each surah has a theme round which its contents revolve and make it into a unified whole. It is the most comprehensive statement of its contents and what the soul is to a body. The theme is to a surah. 2. Together with the main text of a surah, there is an introduction and a conclusion. The content of a surah in some cases can be divided into sections and paragraphs, and in other cases only in paragraphs. Paragraphs depict small shifts in the subject and sections depict greater shifts in it. The verses of the introduction and of the conclusion also may at times be divided into paragraphs as per the subject they discuss. 3. These paragraphs and these sections relate to each other, not through a verse-to-verse linear connection, but through various literary devices like parables, comparison, or parallelism, as well as thorough statements and passages which are conditional, parenthetical, inferential, modifying, cyclic, or which signify corollaries, conclusions, questions, or answers. This, of course, is not an exhaustive list. 4. The text of a surah progresses through these paragraphs and sections and gradually reaches its culmination. As a result, the surah assumes a distinct and unique form and shape and becomes a complete and independent whole. Historical background. The Quran must be understood in the background in which it was revealed. According to established history, it was revealed to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in the 7th century in Arabia. It is evident from this history that Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam explained the Quran wherever and whenever a need arose, and so did the scholars among his companions radiallahu ta'ala anhu and the scholars and researchers after them. The history of the Quran is an established fact and demands the following from its students. Firstly, he must be well aware of the history of the period and place in which the Quran was revealed. Every student of the Quran knows that it mentions the destruction of previous Arab nations like the Ad, the Thamud, and the people of Madian. The views held by these peoples are alluded to by the Quran. It also mentions the preaching of their respective prophets and the way these people reacted to it. Also depicted in the Quran is the arrival of Abraham sallallahu alaihi wasallam into Arabia, the sacrifice of his son Ishmael sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the construction of the Baytullah. The Quran also refers to the influence of Abraham sallallahu alaihi wasallam and Ishmael sallallahu alaihi wasallam on the cultural, moral, social, and economic conditions of Arabia. Also portrayed in the Quran are the alterations done by the Quraysh in the religion constituted by Abraham sallallahu alaihi wasallam and Ishmael sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the way they transformed the Baytullah, the center of monotheism, into a center of idol worship, and the religious innovations and rituals which as a result of this made way into their religion. Similarly, discussed in the Quran are the circumstances in which the Quran was revealed, the incidents which took place at that time, as well as the political and religious views which were in vogue at that time. In order to understand all this, it is essential that the available history of that period be fully benefited from, while keeping it subservient to the words of the Quran and its coherence. Through this, many aspects which the Quran refers to can be understood better, and it is also helpful in unfolding many complexities of the Quran. Secondly, full importance should be given to whatever is mentioned in a hadith and athar literature with reference to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his companions radiallahu ta'ala anhu. No doubt they contain many spurious things, and since the original words have not always been preserved, and a narrator has relied on his own intellect to transmit these words, a lot of changes have come about in the original words. Yet this literature still contains many valuable gems. While pointing out the correct attitude in this regard, Imam Amin Ehsan Islahi writes, among the dhani or non-definite sources of tafsir, ahadith and athar occupy the highest status. If their authenticity could have been fully relied upon, they would have had the same importance in tafsir as the sunnat mutawatira. However, since ahadith and athar do not possess this degree of authenticity, they can only be benefited from as far as they are found to be in conformity with the absolute principles of interpreting the Quran delineated above. Those who give such importance to the hadith that they make the Quran subservient to it are neither aware of the status of the Quran nor that of the hadith. On the other hand, people who don't even refer to the ahadith and athar in interpreting the Quran deprive themselves of a great treasure second only to the Quran. I considered the hadith to be totally derived from the Quran. Thus, I have not confined myself to ahadith which are mentioned in relation to a verse of the Quran. As far as I could, I have tried to benefit from the whole corpus of the hadith. They have helped me the most in understanding the wisdom of the Quran. If I have found a hadith which is not in harmony with the Quran, I have deliberated upon it for a long period, and I have only rejected it when it became abundantly clear to me that it was against the Quran, or it was in conflict with some principle of religion. As far as correct ahadith are concerned, seldom has there arisen a case in which they contradict the Quran. However, when this was the case, I have preferred the Quran to them, and have written my reasons of this preference in detail. Reference Amin Ehsan Islahi, Tadabbur Quran, Volume 1, page 30. Thirdly, whatever scholars and exegetes have written must be given due consideration. It is only by benefiting from the works of previous scholars that new dimensions are added in such disciplines. This cannot be done by ignoring them. True knowledge does not come through arrogance and haughtiness. It comes with humility and a sincere love for the truth. Thus, it is essential that students of the Quran must always study the primary exegetical works on the Quran when they are forming an opinion or deliberating on and teaching a verse. Prior to the leading scholars of the Farahi school who have worked on Quranic exegesis, three primary works on the exegesis of the Quran can be identified. Jami al-Bayan of Ibn Jarir al-Tabari, Al-Tafsir al-Kabir of al-Razi, and Al-Kashaf of al-Zamakhshari. The first of these is a compendium of the opinions of authorities of the past. The second mostly deals with theological issues, and third with declensions and syntax. From among these primary works, though a student of the Quran should only take what is in harmony with the words of the Quran and its coherence and arrangement, however, he should never ignore these works.